It's going to be an exciting night. Welcome to the main event, the Symposium 2013, where the theme is the foolishness of faith. The Christian faith is often viewed as foolishness by those who don't believe it, and it is viewed as life-preserving and giving by those who do. The purpose of the symposium annually is to explore and debate some of the most probing questions about faith, reason, and life through lectures, panel discussions, and debates such as this. We welcome those of you attending tonight's debate here at Elliott Hall of Music at Purdue University, and we welcome those watching this live streaming, some estimated 10,000. Those 10,000 people represent people from every state in America, and as of 10 a.m. this morning, from over 60 countries across the world. This is great. We're happy to include translators tonight so that the deaf community can participate in this for years to come when we put this on YouTube by the end of the month. We are thankful for more than 40 sponsors, many of which were included on the screen behind me as you were entering. Perhaps you saw that, or in the brochures, or on our website at www.symposiachristi.com. We're also grateful to Purdue's philosophy department for sharing the cost of flying in one of our debaters so that he could speak in their department yesterday. My name is Corey Miller, and I will be the moderator for tonight's debate and the MC throughout the weekend, where we've got a fantastic series of talks scheduled for you by a dozen speakers, maybe 35 talks on issues relevant to tonight's debate. I'm on staff with Faculty Commons, the Faculty Ministry of CREW, and I direct the Christian Faculty Staff Network here at Purdue. I'm also a PhD candidate in philosophical theology and teach adjunct courses in philosophy and comparative religions at Indiana University in Kokomo. Our Purdue audience should have a pencil and paper that you were given on your way in to fill out some basic information, including your vote on who won tonight's debate, and you can do that by pencil or complete it online at www.biola.edu/debate. I should go without saying, but please wait until after the debate to decide who won. I know some of us just love our guy that's going to be up here, but it's more fun this way if you wait until after the debate. So we'll collect these right after the debate and prior to the question and answer time, so please write legibly if you're writing. We also want to welcome some special dignitaries who will help formally judge tonight's debate. Wait until all of them are announced, and then please welcome the judges. And judges, once I announce you individually, please stand up and greet the audience. First of all, John Schultz, a fifth-year PhD student in political science and head of the Purdue Pettycrew Debate Forum. He will head up the judge team and has helped organize and form this judge team tonight. Sheila Klinker, on her way. Sheila, she never misses a beat. She'll be here. Sheila graduated from Purdue and is a member of the Indiana State Senate. House of Representatives, a Democrat, representing that. That's the enemy, right? Representing the 27th district since 1982. Ron Alting graduated from Purdue and is a member of the Indiana State Senate, a Republican representing the 22nd District, serving Tippecanoe County. Aaron Trembath, an alum of Purdue's Entrepreneurship and Innovation Program. He is the president and CEO of NanoBio Interfacing Systems, a nanotechnology-based diagnostics company in Purdue's Research Park. And before coaching Purdue's speech and debate team, he was pretty successful in debate himself. Professor Fenggang Yang from Purdue University, a professor of sociology and director of the Center on Religion and Chinese Society. The professor previously taught philosophy at a university in Beijing, China. Professor Martin Medhurst is a distinguished professor of rhetoric and communication and professor of political science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Clark Roundtree, another professor, also flown in here just recently, like Dr. Medhurst. He is professor and chair of the Communications Arts Faculty, flown in tonight from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Let's welcome our distinguished guests. A colleague, Paul Gould, and myself will be editing a book to be published by Routledge based on the proceedings of tonight's debate, which will include the two debaters we'll announce in a moment, the two rhetoric professors we just mentioned, and two other philosophers and two physics professors, with an equal divide of Christians and atheists along the lines. So the debate tonight will continue under the forthcoming title, Is Faith in God Reasonable? Debates in Philosophy, Science, and Rhetoric. We'll let you know when that comes out through your contact information, so make sure you give us the basic information. Turning the corner here, the famous anti-theist Samuel Clemens, otherwise known as Mark Twain, once said, "Faith is believing something you know ain't true." I don't know if that has unanimous consent. The most famous of Jewish and Christian philosophers, perhaps of all time, at least in a particular period, Moses Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas, believed that faith is a virtue. Indeed, Aquinas went so far as to say that without faith, the virtue of faith, none of the other virtues are even virtuous. John Calvin, the Protestant reformer, claimed that it would be the height of absurdity to label ignorance tempered by humility faith, for faith consists in the knowledge of God. For Maimonides, Aquinas, and Calvin, then, faith is part of a knowledge tradition. Yet in contemporary times, the philosopher Norman Malcolm has said that in our Western academic philosophy, religious belief is commonly regarded as unreasonable and is viewed with condescension or even contempt. It is said that religion is a refuge for those who, because of weakness of intellect or character, they're unable to confront the stern realities of the world. The objective, mature, strong attitude is to hold beliefs solely on the basis of evidence. So to this provocative statement, much can and should and now will be said as we turn toward tonight's debate over the question, is faith in God reasonable? Our first debater will argue the affirmative and consequently will go first, as is the tradition when taking the affirmative position. William Lane Craig is research professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology in La Mirada, California. He earned a doctorate in philosophy at the University of Birmingham, England, before taking a doctorate in theology from Ludwig Maximilian's University of Munich in Germany. Prior to his appointment at Talbot, he spent several years at the Higher Institute of Philosophy of the Catholic University Louvain, Belgium. He has authored and edited over 30 books, including The Kalam Cosmological Argument, Assessing the New Testament Evidence for the Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus, Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, and God, Time, and Eternity, as well as over 100 articles in professional journals of philosophy and theology, such as the Journal of Philosophy, New Testament Studies, Philosophical Studies, Philosophy, the British Journal for Philosophy of Science. He is considered to be one of the foremost defenders of the Christian faith. His book, here, third edition, Reasonable Faith, Christian Truth, and Apologetics, matches his website, which is reasonablefaith.org. Please welcome with me Dr. William Lane Craig. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next debater will argue the negative and consequently will go second. He will have the final word in the debate. Alex Rosenberg is the R. Taylor Cole Professor of Philosophy and Department Head at Duke University, with secondary appointments in the Biology and Political Science departments. He completed his dissertation at the Johns Hopkins University on a philosophical analysis of microeconomic laws. In addition to nearly 40 articles or chapters, he is author of more than a dozen books, some of which have been translated into multiple languages. Dr. Rosenberg has been a visiting professor and fellow of the Center for the Philosophy of Science, University of Minnesota, as well as the department, the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Oxford University, and a visiting fellow of the philosophy department at the Research School of Social Science of the Australian National University. That's a long sentence. He has held fellowships from the National Science Foundation, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation. In 1993, Dr. Rosenberg received the Lakatos Award in the Philosophy of Science. In 2006 and in 2007, he held a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He was also the Phi Beta Kappa Romanel Lecturer for the 2006-2007 year. On one website listing the world's 50 most famous atheists in the world, Dr. Rosenberg ranks number 13. And his recent book is The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. Please welcome with me Dr. Alex Rosenberg. The debate rules for tonight. The structure of the debate will be as follows. Each speaker will have a 20-minute opening statement followed by two 12-minute rebuttals and then two 8-minute rebuttals. The speakers will then provide a 5-minute closing statement. In all, the actual debate should take 90 minutes, 45 minutes for each position to make their case. There will then be a 30 to 45-minute Q&A period, according to which we will take questions from our live audience here at Purdue and from our live streaming audience across the world, perhaps. If either of the debaters goes over their allotted time, we will give them a 15-second grace period. We're very graceful, gracious, and then promptly ask them to terminate their time. We will have a modest interaction between the professors in order to give a response to maybe answers that they give to you. Professor Craig will approach the lectern first. Dr. Craig? And then when he begins, the time begins. Timer, are you ready?
All right.
Begin.
Well, good evening. I'm delighted to be able to participate in tonight's debate, and I count it a real privilege to be discussing this important issue with Dr. Rosenberg. Tonight, we're interested in discussing some of the arguments that make belief in God reasonable or unreasonable. So, in my opening speech, I'm going to present several arguments which I think make it reasonable to believe that God exists. Then, in my second speech, I'll respond to Dr. Rosenberg's arguments against the reasonableness of belief in God. I believe that God's existence best explains a wide range of the data of human experience. Let me just mention eight. First, God is the best explanation of why anything at all exists. Suppose you were hiking through the forest and came upon a ball lying on the ground. You would naturally wonder how it came to be there. If your hiking buddy said to you, "Just forget about it, it just exists inexplicably," you would think either that he was joking or that he wanted you to just keep moving. No one would take seriously the idea that the ball just exists without any explanation. Now, notice that merely increasing the size of the ball, even until it becomes coextensive with the universe, does nothing to provide or remove the need for an explanation of its existence. So, what is the explanation of the existence of the universe? Whereby the universe, I mean all of space-time reality. The explanation of the universe can lie only in a transcendent reality, beyond the universe, beyond space and time, which is metaphysically necessary in its existence. Now, there's only one way I can think of to get a contingent universe from a necessarily existing cause. And that is if the cause is a personal agent who can freely choose to create a contingent reality. It therefore follows that the best explanation of the existence of the contingent universe is a transcendent personal being, which is what everybody means by God. We can summarize this reasoning as follows. One, every contingent thing has an explanation of its existence. Two, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is a transcendent personal being. Three, the universe is a contingent thing. Four, therefore, the universe has an explanation of its existence. Five, therefore, the explanation of the universe is a transcendent personal being, which is what everybody means by God. Second, God is the best explanation of the origin of the universe. We have pretty strong evidence that the universe is not eternal in the past, but had an absolute beginning a finite time ago. In 2003, Arvin Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin were able to prove that any universe which has on average been in a state of cosmic expansion cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a past space-time boundary. What makes their proof so powerful is that it holds regardless of the physical description of the very early universe. Because we don't yet have a quantum theory of gravity, we can't yet provide a physical description of the first split second of the universe. But the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem is independent of any physical description of that moment. Their theorem implies that the quantum vacuum state, which may have characterized the early universe, cannot be eternal in the past, but must have had an absolute beginning. Even if our universe is just a tiny part of a so-called multiverse composed of many universes, their theorem requires that the multiverse itself must have had an absolute beginning. Of course, highly speculative scenarios such as loop quantum gravity models, string models, even closed time-like curves have been proposed to try to avoid this absolute beginning. These models are fraught with problems, but the bottom line is that none of these models, even if true, succeeds in restoring an eternal past. Last spring, at a conference in Cambridge celebrating the 70th birthday of Stephen Hawking, Vilenkin delivered a paper entitled, Did the Universe Have a Beginning?, which surveyed current cosmology with respect to that question. He argued, and I quote, none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal. He concluded, all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. But then the inevitable question arises, why did the universe come into being? What brought the universe into existence? There must have been a transcendent cause which brought the universe into being. We can summarize our argument thus far as follows. One, the universe began to exist. Two, if the universe began to exist, then the universe has a transcendent cause. Three, therefore, the universe has a transcendent cause. By the very nature of the case, that cause must be a transcendent immaterial being. Now, there are only two possible things that could fit that description. Either an abstract object, like a number, or an unembodied mind or consciousness. But abstract objects don't stand in causal relations. The number seven, for example, has no effect on anything. Therefore, the cause of the universe is plausibly an unembodied mind or person. And thus we are brought not merely to a transcendent cause of the universe, but to its personal creator. Three, God is the best explanation of the applicability of mathematics to the physical world. Philosophers and scientists have puzzled over what physicist Eugene Wigner called the uncanny effectiveness of mathematics. How is it that a mathematical theorist like Peter Higgs can sit down at his desk and by poring over mathematical equations predict the existence of a fundamental particle which experimentalists 30 years later, after investing millions of dollars and thousands of man-hours, are finally able to detect? Mathematics is the language of nature. But how is this to be explained? If mathematical objects are abstract entities causally isolated from the universe, then the applicability of mathematics is, in the words of philosopher of mathematics Penelope Matty, a happy coincidence. On the other hand, if mathematical objects are just useful fictions, how is it that nature is written in the language of these fictions? In his book, Dr. Rosenberg emphasizes that naturalism doesn't tolerate cosmic coincidences. But the naturalist has no explanation of the uncanny applicability of mathematics to the physical world. By contrast, the theist has a ready explanation. When God created the physical universe, he designed it on the mathematical structure he had in mind. We can summarize this argument as follows. One, if God did not exist, the applicability of mathematics would be a happy coincidence. Two, the applicability of mathematics is not a happy coincidence. Three, therefore, God exists. Fourth, God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. In recent decades, scientists have been stunned by the discovery that the initial conditions of the Big Bang were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life with a precision and delicacy that literally defy human comprehension. Now, there are three live explanatory options for this extraordinary fine-tuning. Physical necessity, chance, or design. Physical necessity is not, however, a plausible explanation because the finely tuned constants and quantities are independent of the laws of nature, and therefore they are not physically necessary. So could the fine-tuning be due to chance? The problem with this explanation is that the odds of a life-permitting universe governed by our laws of nature are just so infinitesimal that they cannot be reasonably faced. Therefore, the proponents of chance have been forced to postulate the existence of a world ensemble of other universes, preferably infinite in number and randomly ordered, so that life-permitting universes would appear by chance somewhere in the ensemble. Not only is this hypothesis, to borrow Richard Dawkins' phrase, an unparsimonious extravagance, but it faces an insuperable objection. By far, most of the observable universes in a world ensemble would be worlds in which a single brain fluctuates into existence out of the vacuum and observes its otherwise empty world. Thus, if our world were just a random member of a world ensemble, we ought to be having observations like that. Since we don't, that strongly disconfirms the world ensemble hypothesis. So chance is also not a good explanation. It follows that design is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe. And thus the fine-tuning of the universe constitutes evidence for a cosmic designer. Fifth, God is the best explanation of intentional states of consciousness in the world. Philosophers are puzzled by states of intentionality. Intentionality is the property of being about something or of something. It signifies the object directedness of our thoughts. For example, I can think about my summer vacation, or I can think of my wife. No physical object has this sort of intentionality. A chair or a stone or a glob of tissue like the brain is not about or of something else. Only mental states or states of consciousness are about other things. As a materialist, Dr. Rosenberg recognizes this fact and so concludes that on atheism, there really are no intentional states. Dr. Rosenberg boldly claims that we never really think about anything. But this seems incredible. Obviously, I am thinking about Dr. Rosenberg's argument. This seems to me to be a reductio ad absurdum of atheism. By contrast, on theism, because God is a mind, it's hardly surprising that there should be finite minds. Thus, intentional states fit comfortably into a theistic worldview. So, we may argue, one, if God did not exist, intentional states of consciousness would not exist. Two, but intentional states of consciousness do exist. Three, therefore, God exists. Number six, God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties in the world. In moral experience, we apprehend moral values and duties which impose themselves as objectively binding and true. For example, we all recognize that it's wrong to walk into an elementary school with an automatic weapon and to shoot little boys and girls and their teachers. On a naturalistic view, however, there's nothing really wrong with this. Moral values are just the subjective byproducts of biological evolution and social conditioning. Dr. Rosenberg is brutally honest about the implications of his atheism. He writes, "There is no such thing as morally right or wrong. Individual human life is meaningless and without ultimate moral value. We need to face the fact that nihilism is true." By contrast, the theist grounds objective moral values in God and our moral duties in his commands. The theist thus has the explanatory resources which the atheist lacks to ground objective moral values and duties. Hence, we may argue, one, objective moral values and duties exist. Two, but if God did not exist, objective moral values and duties would not exist, from which it follows, three, therefore, God exists. Number seven, God is the best explanation of the historical facts about Jesus of Nazareth. Historians have reached something of a consensus that Jesus came on the scene with an unprecedented sense of divine authority, the authority to stand and speak in God's place. He claimed that in himself the kingdom of God had come. And as visible demonstrations of this fact, he carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcisms. But the supreme confirmation of his claim was his resurrection from the dead. If Jesus did rise from the dead, then it would seem that we have a divine miracle on our hands and thus evidence for the existence of God. Now, I realize that most people probably think that the resurrection of Jesus is something you just accept by faith or not. But there are actually three facts recognized by the majority of historians today, which I believe are best explained by the resurrection of Jesus. Fact number one, on the Sunday after his crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. Two, on separate occasions, different individuals and groups of people saw appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And three, the original disciples suddenly came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus despite having every predisposition to the contrary. The eminent British scholar N.T. Wright, near the end of his 800-page study of the historicity of Jesus' resurrection, concludes that the empty tomb and post-mortem appearances of Jesus have been established to such a high degree of historical probability as to be, and I quote, virtually certain, akin to the death of Caesar Augustus in A.D. 17 or the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Naturalistic attempts to explain away these three great facts, like the disciples stole the body or Jesus wasn't really dead, have been universally rejected by contemporary scholarship. The simple fact is that there just is no plausible naturalistic explanation of these facts. And therefore, it seems to me, the Christian is amply justified in believing that Jesus rose from the dead and was who he claimed to be. But that entails that God exists. Thus, we have a good inductive argument to the existence of God based on the facts concerning the resurrection of Jesus. Finally, number 8, God can be personally known and experienced. This isn't really an argument for God's existence. Rather, it's the claim that you can know that God exists wholly apart from arguments, simply by personally experiencing him. Philosophers call beliefs like this properly basic beliefs. They aren't based on some other beliefs. Rather, they're part of the foundations of a person's system of beliefs. Other properly basic beliefs would be belief in the reality of the past or the existence of the external world. In the same way, belief in God is for those who seek him a properly basic belief grounded in our experience of God. Now, if this is so, then there's a danger that arguments for God could actually distract our attention from God himself. The Bible promises, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. We mustn't so concentrate on the external proofs that we fail to hear the inner voice of God speaking to our own hearts. For those who listen, God becomes a personal reality in their lives. In summary, then, we've seen 8 respects in which God provides a better explanation of the world than naturalism. God is the best explanation of why anything at all exists. God is the best explanation of the origin of the universe. God is the best explanation of the applicability of mathematics to the physical world. God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. God is the best explanation of intentional states of consciousness in the world. God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties in the world. God is the best explanation of the historical facts concerning Jesus' resurrection. And finally, God can be personally known and experienced. For all of these reasons, I think that belief in God is eminently reasonable. If Dr. Rosenberg is to persuade us otherwise, he must first tear down all 8 of the reasons that I've presented, and then in their place erect a case of his own to show why belief in God is unreasonable. Unless and until he does that, I think we should agree that it is reasonable to believe in God.
Do we have a timer on this side, or is it just... Okay. Okay, that ends Dr. Craig's opening statement. Dr. Rosenberg will now approach his lectern, and when I say begin, then Professor Rosenberg may begin his 20-minute opening statement. Timer, are you ready? Okay, Dr. Rosenberg, you may begin.
Thanks, Corey, and thank you for the invitation. As Yogi Berra, the famous Yankee catcher once said, I appreciate your making this night necessary. So I don't know whether to laugh or to cry. I hope you didn't pay money to come to tonight's debate, because everything that Dr. Craig said, almost everything actually, he said many times before in many different debates, almost in the same order, and all of them available on the Internet. So, you know, you didn't need to come out in this really cold night here in West Lafayette to hear these debates again and to hear these arguments again. And in particular, what's remarkable about them is how impervious they are to the previous discussions and criticisms that they've been exposed to. They're exactly the same as 7 or 8 or 9 Internet presentations of his arguments in the past. And what it leads me to ask is Dr. Craig infallible, or does he just not listen? Probably the latter. He probably doesn't listen to what his interlocutors have suggested. And I don't think that he listens because he's really not interested in getting at the truth. He's interested in scoring debate points. There are 2 moves that Dr. Craig almost always makes. First, there's the burden of proof claim. As though we were in a court of law, as though it was a question of the defending attorney and the prosecuting attorney engaged in an adversarial procedure. And the other thing that you often hear is, all I need to show to win is. So, for example, at the very end of his remarks, he said, I've got 8 arguments, and he's got to refute all 8 of them or else I win. You know, philosophy and theology don't proceed by courtroom-style debate. We're engaged in a cooperative search for the truth, both theists and atheists, not an adversarial contest for victory. This is the wrong format for a profitable discussion of faith or God or science and reason. But let's turn to the substance of the matter. Our topic is whether faith in God is reasonable. But, of course, by definition, faith is a belief in the absence of evidence. So I'm going to give Dr. Craig the benefit of the doubt and accept the change that he has made in the terms of the debate. It now turns out that what we're arguing about is whether belief in God is reasonable. And the God we're talking about is the God of the Abrahamic religions, the God of Islam, of Christianity, and Judaism. It's not the milk and water deism of, for example, the founding fathers, Jefferson, Adams, Monroe, perhaps even George Washington. The God we're talking about has the following features. If he exists, he's got the 3 omnis and benevolence. He's got omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, and an unqualifiedly good will. If these 4 features are incompatible with some obvious fact, then, of course, the theist's God is non-existent. Can I have some water, Corey? Let's be clear that we're arguing about theism here. And in thinking about theism and in thinking about science, thank you, Corey. There's something else that we had better keep in mind. Dr. Craig is very confident about his take on fundamental physics, on important and controversial questions about which physicists have not attained consensus. But the important thing to bear in mind in thinking about his take, the sides he chose, the confidence with which he presents his take, the important thing to bear in mind is this. There are 2,000 members of the National Academy of Sciences, the most important body of the most distinguished scientists in the United States, of which 4 are faculty here at Purdue, and 2 of the 2 Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, of course, are both members of the National Academy of Science. Of these 2,000 people, 95% of them are atheists, and the percentage for the physicists is even higher. What do these people know about physics that Dr. Craig doesn't know? Is it a coincidence that this number of the members of the National Academy of Science are unbelievers? I think it isn't, and I think it requires us to take with a certain lack of confidence the claims that Dr. Craig makes about science, and I'm going to controvert some of those claims right now. In particular, many of the arguments that Dr. Craig gave tonight, and which he has given repeatedly in the past, rest on the first cause argument, an argument that goes back certainly to St. Thomas Aquinas and probably to Aristotle. And it rests on, of course, the principle of sufficient reason, the principle that everything that exists must have a cause. Now, the remarkable thing about this argument and the principle of sufficient reason, as it's called, on which it rests, is that the principle is plainly false. Okay? It's refuted trillions of times every second throughout the universe. It's refuted in this room, and I'll give you a pretty full explanation of why. Take 2 uranium-238 atoms, okay, that are absolutely indistinguishable. In a given moment, these 2 indistinguishable atoms, atoms of exactly the same mass and energy state, have the following difference. One produces an alpha particle spontaneously and the other doesn't. And there is no cause whatsoever for that difference. That's what quantum mechanics tells us. Suddenly one emits an alpha particle and the other doesn't. And there's no cause whatever for that difference between them. Now, you might think that that's not a very important fact of nature, but 1 mole, 1 Avogadro's number of uranium-238 molecules emits 3 million alpha particles a second. And every helium atom on this planet is one of those alpha particles. And the smoke detectors that operate all through this auditorium to protect us from fires, those operate because of the indeterminate, unexplained, completely spontaneous appearance of an alpha particle out of a uranium atom in these systems. For Dr. Craig to insist on the arguments that rest on the claim that every event had a cause that had to have brought it into being is just bluff. Right? It's not a principle accepted in physics. And you can't argue from its intuitive attractiveness. Let's consider the fine-tuning argument, another of the claims about science that Dr. Craig makes. This is the argument that the charge on the electron, the gravitational constant, the mass of the electron, Planck's constant, the Hubble constant, the cosmic density parameter, that they're all so beautifully arranged to make human life actual, that there must have been some purpose or design that brought them into being in order to do that. That's the best explanation. Well, to begin with, this is terrible carbon chauvinism. If these constants had been slightly different, maybe there would be intelligent life in the universe that's germanium-based or silicon-based. Look at the periodic table of the elements. Look at the atoms around carbon in the periodic table and ask yourself whether, if some of these constants have been slightly different, whether there might not be intelligent creatures in the universe that are differently composed from us. More important, physics ruled out the kind of teleology, the kind of purpose of thinking that Dr. Craig invokes here 400 years ago. And if it's one thing that physics is not going to go back to and turn around and accept in its search for the fundamental nature of reality, it's the invocation of purposes. There are, of course, in physical theory at least two different ways in which the particular way in which the constants of our part of the universe could have come into existence, while there being an indefinitely large number of other combinations of constants making up other inaccessible regions either of this universe or of other universes. So the inflationary period soon after the Big Bang produced regions of space by completely quantum mechanical indeterministic symmetry breaking, right, which are inaccessible to us, which are beyond our horizon, our event horizon. There are possibly indefinitely many of these. Okay? And for all we know, there may be life or there may not be life in them. And then, of course, string theory and M theory tell us that there are minimally 10 to the 500th different kinds of possible universes or actual universes bubbling up out of the quantum foam of the eternally existing multi-universe. I'm not going to take sides on these varying theories, but I defy Professor Craig to argue from authority that it is impossible for something to have been created from nothing. The symmetry breaking, which is characteristic of the cascade of events that occurred in our universe and which produces our universe in addition to the indefinitely many other universes bubbling up out of the quantum foam of the multiverse, that symmetry breaking is another example of the violation of the principle of sufficient reason on which Dr. Craig stakes so many of his arguments. Let's turn to something much more accessible, objective values. Now, Dr. Craig's argument that only God can underwrite objective values was refuted by Plato in 390 BC in an argument that he gives in the first and the simplest of his dialogues, the Euthyphro. I'm very tempted to say to Dr. Craig, what part of no, Euthyphro, don't you understand? The question that Plato raises in the Euthyphro goes like this. Take your favorite moral norm. Gay marriage is forbidden, or FGM is required, or thou shalt not kill. Take your favorite moral norm. Ask yourself this question. Is it morally right because God chose it? Or did God choose it because it's morally right? We all know the answer to this question. The answer to this question is God chose it because it's morally right. And what that means, of course, is that the moral rightness of thou shalt not kill is entirely independent fact from God's choosing it. It's because he recognized the moral rightness of thou shalt not kill that he imposed it on us. And that means that the mere fact that it's God who imposed it on us doesn't explain the nature of objective value. It's that further fact that he was wise enough and smart enough to detect about thou shalt not kill that made it the morally right value for us. Okay? And this is a point that Socrates makes to Euthyphro in the first and simplest of the dialogues. And it is a problem that theological ethics has wrestled with ever since. The only option in responding to this argument is the divine command theory, a theory that has had its exponents all the way back to William of Ockham. And the trouble with divine command theory is that in order to articulate that theory, in order to defend it, in order to make it sound plausible, you have to already commit yourself to there being some normative fact, some moral fact about the moral rules that make them right, independent of God saying, you do it or you go to hell. Okay? There's a rightness about moral norms that cannot be exhausted by the mere fact that it was handed down on the mountain by Moses from God. Now, natural selection is a theory, of course, about how we came to be moral, why we're moral, about what the ecological conditions are that made us moral. It explains our morality, but it doesn't necessarily explain away our morality. That requires something else, okay? And the suggestion that without God, the naturalist, the Darwinian, has no basis on which to underwrite his normative commitment, that again is bluff, and in fact, it's the person who claims that it's God that gave normative morality to us that explains its normative rightness is the person who has, regrettably to use the expression that Dr. Craig so invokes, the burden of proof of explaining what is it about God that makes for the moral rightness of the ethical norms that he imposes on us. And there are, of course, any number of alternative ethical theories that underwrite the objectivity of ethics, among them utilitarianism and social contract theory and ideal observer theory and Hume's theory of the sympathies and the Kantian theory of the categorical imperative. And the real problem for Dr. Craig is he needs to refute each of these normative theories in order to show that there's no other basis for ethics than God, and the resources that he would use to cast doubt on these theories also cast doubt on the divine command theory. So, let's turn to the argument from the New Testament. I am sort of gobsmacked as a philosopher that he should persist in propounding this preposterous argument. Ask yourself the following question. In 1827... Joseph Smith got 11 people to certify that they observed the golden tablets, which he, an illiterate person, was able to translate from Reform Egyptian, okay, and convey the Book of Mormon to the Mormon, to the Latter-day Saints. Do we believe on the basis of those 11 certificates that are only about 160 years old that the Book of Mormon is the revealed word of God? The Quran tells us that Muhammad ascended to heaven from the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, on the 26th of February, 621. And there are millions and millions of Muslims all over the world who are committed to that great truth. Do you think we in this room should believe it? Right? Scientology, that claims 8 million adherents throughout the world, Scientology tells us that 75 million years ago, Somebody named Zeno brought billions of people to Earth on spaceships that look like DC-8s. And who are we to believe that there are 55,000 people in the United States or 8 million people around the world who really believe this too? Is there any reason why we should accept the certification of L. Ron Hubbard and the Church of Scientology that this actually happened? No, of course not. How many of you are familiar with the statues of Madonna taken out from their churches once a year which shed tears? Of course, as scientists, we know exactly what the physical properties are of these statues and how the rapid and sudden change of temperature between the inside and the outside of the cathedral produces condensation, which the devout believe to be tears. But that's no reason for us to believe it. Think about this. 53 of the first 62 DNA exonerations of people who turned out to be innocent of charges of capital crimes in the United States, 53 of these people were convicted on eyewitness testimony. We know from cognitive social science how unreliable eyewitness testimony is today. Why should we suppose that eyewitness testimony from 33 AD is any more reliable? This, as an argument for God's existence, seems to me to be bizarre. Of course, the killer argument for against God's existence is the argument from evil. It's enough to show that theism is unreasonable, and it, of course, is the principal reason for apostasy from the Christian faith and the Jewish faith and Islam all through the centuries. And the argument is simple and terrible. Okay, and it goes like this. One, if the theist God exists, he's omnipotent and benevolent. A benevolent creature eliminates suffering to the extent that the benevolent creature can. Therefore, if there's a God and he's omnipotent and benevolent, he eliminates all suffering. But as we know, it's obvious that there's plenty of suffering in the world, both man-made and natural suffering. So if there's a God, then he is either not omnipotent or not benevolent or not either omnipotent or benevolent, and theism is false. The problem of evil is theism's problem from hell. Now, I want to say one last thing about the problem of evil and about the potential responses that Dr. Craig will make and that he has made in the past. And I need to make something about my own personal history clear here. There are a lot of responses to the problem of evil that I find morally offensive. And I find them morally offensive for a certain reason. I'm the child of Holocaust survivors. All of my family, except my parents, were killed by the Nazis, including two half-brothers of mine. Okay? I will not take kindly, okay, to a suggestion that Dr. Craig has made repeatedly in debate fora like this, that the innocent children who died in the Holocaust, including or died at the hands of the soldiers of Israel in Canaan, that these innocent children like my half-brothers were more fortunate, were luckier, because they ascended to heaven directly than the SS soldiers who killed them and lived very nice, very comfortable, very long lives in West Germany after World War II. I am not going to take kindly to that kind of an exculpation of theism. In particular, Dr. Craig has said before and said in one sentence, at least tonight, that nobody has ever shown the incompatibility of theism and suffering, that it's part of divine plan that's beyond our cognizance. Well, the argument that I sketched, the argument from evil, is a logical deduction which shows the incompatibility of an omnipotent and benevolent creature with suffering on this planet. And it's not enough to fob it off on the mystery of God's plan or on the mere logical compatibility of these two views. Now, I've got to stop, and in the reply I'm going to want to take up the two new arguments that Dr. Craig introduced, the argument from mathematics and the argument from intentionality. But I think I've put enough on the table for him to rejoin. Thank you.
All All right, Dr. Craig will now begin his 12-minute rebuttal. Timer, go ahead and begin when he begins to speak.
I noticed that in Dr. Rosenberg's opening speech, he didn't really present many arguments against the reasonableness of belief in God. He gestured in the direction of the problem of evil, but he didn't really develop it. The problem is that that argument is based upon controversial premises, such as that if God is all-powerful, he can just create any world that he wants, and that if God is all-good, he would want to create a world without evil. And neither one of those is necessarily true, and that is why among philosophers, even atheists, the logical version of the problem of evil is widely rejected. So what Dr. Rosenberg needs to show is that it is impossible that God could have morally sufficient reasons for permitting the suffering in the world, and until he does that, he hasn't even begun to offer a problem of evil that disproves theism. Rather, when you read Dr. Rosenberg's work, what you discover is that his skepticism about God's existence is really rooted in his scientism or naturalism, which make it unreasonable to believe in God. But here I think it's absolutely crucial that we distinguish between two types of naturalism that Dr. Rosenberg tends to blur together. Epistemological naturalism, which says that science is the only source of knowledge, and metaphysical naturalism, which says that only physical things exist. Let me say a word about each one of these. First, with respect to epistemological naturalism, I want to make two points. First, it's a false theory of knowledge for two reasons. First, it's overly restrictive. There are truths that cannot be proven by natural science, and the success of natural science in discovering truths about the physical world does nothing to show that it's the only source of knowledge and truth. Secondly, it's self-refuting. The statement, natural science is the only source of knowledge, is not itself a scientific statement, and therefore it cannot be true. For these two reasons, epistemological naturalism is a false theory of knowledge that is widely rejected by philosophers. But leave that point aside. The really important point for tonight's debate is the second, that epistemological naturalism does not imply metaphysical naturalism. A case in point would be Willard Quine, the most famous epistemological naturalist of the 20th century. Quine showed himself to be commendably open to the reality of non-physical entities. He wrote, "If I saw indirect explanatory benefit in positing possibilia, spirits, a creator, I would joyfully accord them scientific status too, on a par with such avowedly scientific posits as quarks and black holes." And in fact, Quine was as good as his word, for he did posit the existence of immaterial, non-physical objects, namely mathematical objects like sets. Quine's case shows that the epistemological naturalist need not be a metaphysical naturalist. But secondly, my arguments for the existence of God. Many of my arguments do just what Quine said. They show, on the basis of scientific evidence, the explanatory benefit of positing God. And so they are acceptable to the epistemological naturalist. The epistemological naturalist can, and I think should be, a theist. So the real issue in the debate tonight is not epistemological, but metaphysical naturalism. And Dr. Rosenberg hasn't given us any reason to think that metaphysical naturalism is true. So what can we say about metaphysical naturalism? Well, again, I want to make two points. First, my arguments for the existence of God show that metaphysical naturalism is not true. There is a personal, transcendent reality beyond the physical universe. But secondly, I think that metaphysical naturalism is so contrary to reason and experience as to be absurd. And in the following arguments, the first premise in every case is taken from Dr. Rosenberg's own book. So, first, the argument from intentionality. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, I cannot think about anything. That's because there are no intentional states. But, two, I am thinking about naturalism, from which it follows, three, therefore, naturalism is not true. So if you think that you ever think about anything, you should conclude that naturalism is false. Second, the argument from meaning. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, no sentence has any meaning. And he says that all the sentences in his own book are, in fact, meaningless. But premise two, premise one has meaning. We all understood it. And therefore, it follows that three, naturalism is not true. Third, argument from truth. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, there are no true sentences. And that's because they're all meaningless. But two, premise one is true. That's what the naturalist believes and asserts, from which it follows three, therefore naturalism is not true. Fourth, the argument from moral praise and blame. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, then I am not morally praiseworthy or blameworthy for any of my actions because, as I said, on his view, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But two, I am morally praiseworthy and blameworthy for at least some of my actions. If you think that you've ever done something truly wrong or truly good, then you should conclude that three, therefore, naturalism is not true. Fifth, the argument from freedom. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, I do not do anything freely. Everything is determined. But two, I can freely agree or disagree with premise one, from which it follows three, therefore, naturalism is not true. Sixth, the argument from purpose. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, I do not plan to do anything. But two, I planned to come to tonight's debate. That's why I'm here. I'm here. From which it follows three, therefore naturalism is not true. Seventh, the argument from enduring. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, I do not endure for 2 moments of time. But two, I have been sitting here for more than a minute. If you think that you're the same person who walked into the room tonight, then you should agree that three, therefore naturalism, is not true. And finally, the argument from personal existence. This is perhaps the coup de grace against naturalism. According to Dr. Rosenberg, if naturalism is true, I do not exist. He says there are no selves, there are no persons, no first-person perspectives. But two, I do exist. I know this as certainly as I know anything, from which it follows, therefore, naturalism is not true. In a word, metaphysical naturalism is absurd. And notice that my argument is not that it is unappealing. Rather, it is that metaphysical naturalism flies in the face of reason and experience and is therefore untenable. So, in sum, epistemological naturalism is consistent with theism, and metaphysical naturalism is absurd. So let's now return to those arguments that I offered for God's existence and see how Dr. Rosenberg responded to some of them. He didn't respond to the first argument, why anything exists rather than nothing. As for the origin of the universe, he says, but not everything has a cause. In quantum mechanics, virtual particles come to be without a cause. Notice that he misstates the first premise, which is that the universe began to exist, and then the second, if the universe began to exist, the universe has a transcendent cause. That's because the universe can't come into being out of nothing, and virtual particles don't come out of nothing. They come out of the quantum vacuum, which is a sea of roiling energy. Moreover, in quantum mechanics, it's not clear that these entities are, in fact, uncaused. There are deterministic interpretations of quantum mechanics, according to which the behavior of these particles is fully determined. And finally, number three, I would say in response to this, that the origin of the universe, you have to believe the entire universe could come into being from non-being in order for it to come to exist without a cause. And I think that takes more faith than belief in the existence of God. He didn't reply to the argument about the applicability of mathematics in the world. As for the fine-tuning argument, he simply appealed here once again to the multiverse hypothesis. But I refuted that in my opening speech. If we were just a random member of a multiverse or world ensemble, then we ought to be having totally different observations than the ones that we in fact have. And therefore, that's why physicists like Roger Penrose have concluded that multiverse hypotheses are impotent to explain the fine-tuning of the universe. He says perhaps you could have another basis for life, like silicon. What he doesn't appreciate is that in the absence of fine-tuning, there wouldn't even be matter. There wouldn't even be chemistry, much less stars and planets where life might evolve. So I don't think he really understands the extent of the fine-tuning of the universe and the catastrophic consequences that would ensue if it were not finely tuned. Intentional states of consciousness he didn't respond to. As for objective moral values, in his book, he admits that naturalism faces an even worse problem than the Euthyphro dilemma. For the theist, the Euthyphro dilemma is easy to solve. Namely, you craft a third alternative, that God himself is the good, and that his commands are necessary expressions of his moral nature. So they are neither arbitrary, nor is the good something external to God. But on Dr. Rosenberg's view, there is no basis for moral value or moral objectivity, and that's why he is a moral nihilist who doesn't think that anything is truly right or wrong. As for the resurrection of Jesus, he just doesn't understand, I think, the credibility of the New Testament documents in this regard. You can't compare them to Joseph Smith, which were probably lies, or to Muhammad's ascension, which is probably a legend, because in this case we are dealing with early eyewitness testimony that is not the result of conspiracy or lie. These people sincerely believed what they said. And that's why most historians accept those three facts. And therefore, the naturalist has got to come up with some alternative explanation. You can't indict eyewitness testimony in general and then use that against a specific case. You'd have to show in the specific case of the Gospels that this testimony is unreliable. And that is not the opinion of the majority of historians who have investigated these documents. So, for all of these reasons, I think his metaphysical naturalism is wholly unreasonable, whereas theism, by contrast, I think is eminently reasonable and plausible.
All right, as soon as Dr. Rosenberg begins, he has his 12-minute rebuttal. Timer begin when he begins.
Gee, what a lot to cover. So I guess the way to begin is to say I read this book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality. I actually didn't want to call it The Atheist's Guide to Reality. I wanted to call it something else, but my editor said, you'll sell a lot more books and even get yourself invited to a debate like this if you title a book like this. But, of course, the important thing to remember about that book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, is the structure of its argument, which was science has a number of important implications. In fact, first couple of pages of my book, I identify 14 of these implications, and most of them sound really bizarro, just the way Professor Craig suggested in his remarks. But the real issue is that among these 14 implications of science that I argued follow in my book, one of them is atheism, and the others are that set of doctrines that Dr. Craig described as absurd. None of them is supposed to follow from atheism. None of the things that he says are manifestly false and that I've argued for in my book follow from atheism, and therefore, of course, the modus tollens argument, as we call it in logic, that Professor Craig is trying to advance is based on a complete misrepresentation of what it says in that book. What it says in that book is that all these alleged absurdities, along with atheism, follow from the truth of science. Now, you can reject all of these alleged absurdities, but if I'm right about the logical structure of my argument, you've got to reject science. And I don't think Dr. Craig wants to reject science because he's building God on his interpretation of what science is supposed to show. The other thing you can do, of course, is, as many of my philosophical colleagues are wont to do, is reject the argument that I mount about what science shows regarding these issues like free will and the nature of the self and the grounds of morality and the purposelessness of the universe. That's an interesting and important set of issues in philosophy, and there are issues in the philosophy of science about the relationship between science and the agenda of the persistent questions of philosophy. They are not questions about the relationship between atheism and these persistent questions, and it's simply a callow mistake to suppose that you could refute atheism by controverting these controversial doctrines that I argue for in philosophy. We didn't come here tonight to debate metaphysical naturalism or epistemological naturalism. We came here to debate whether the belief in God, faith in God, or as I've insisted, we ought to substitute belief in God, is reasonable or not. And that question has practically nothing to do with whether the strange theses that I argue for in this book are right or not. I would cherish the opportunity to discuss the details of these arguments with Professor Craig. Let's just take one example, the problem of intentionality. The problem of intentionality is a really hard problem to understand in philosophy. Dr. Craig mentioned a couple of times that it's the intentionality is the fact that our thoughts appear to be about stuff, like I'm thinking about Craig now, and I'm thinking about the timer that says I got 8.5 minutes to finish my rebuttal. I'm thinking about stuff. How is that possible? How is it possible for one chunk of matter, my brain, to be about, intrinsically about, another chunk of matter, Dr. Craig, or the sign that now says 8 minutes? That is a profound mystery in philosophy with which philosophers have been trying to wrestle, certainly since Descartes, and I think since Plato made the point in the Meno, one of his other dialogues. How is it possible for one chunk of matter, the brain, to be intrinsically about, directed at, pointing at another chunk of matter? Now, you may think that's not a problem, that's not very difficult, but if you start reading Descartes, and you read Leibniz, and you read the philosophers in the tradition of Western philosophy, you'll see that it's a huge problem, okay? And it's a problem for science, for neuroscience, okay? How is it that the wet stuff in the brain can do this, okay? There are two answers to this question. One is Descartes' answer of dualism. There is a mind, and it's independent of the brain. It's a totally different spiritual substance. Theists love this argument for obvious reasons. If there's a spiritual substance in us, a soul, a person, a self, independent of our brain, well, then, of course, if it's not physical, it's indestructible, and it's well on its way to immortality, which is just what the Christian religion wants us to believe, okay? That's dualism, okay? Most scientists aren't dualists. There's the odd exception, you know, Eccles and even some philosophers like Descartes or Popper. But most scientists, most neuroscientists think that cognition is a brain process, okay? And the problem, okay? And the problem is to explain how the brain process, one chunk of matter, can have this property of aboutness. And that question has nothing to do, nothing interesting to do with atheism or theism. Let's take the matter of numbers, okay? Dr. Craig says it's a miracle, it's a wild coincidence that mathematics is applicable to science on my view. Well, he hasn't reckoned with the remarkable number of alternative mathematical objects that mathematics have conjured up, have thought about, have theorized about, or about the remarkable range of possible mathematical functions relating these objects. Okay? The fact is that we know that there are indefinitely many mathematical objects and indefinitely many functions relating these mathematical objects, and it's a sheer argument from ignorance to suggest that the number is so small, the number that apply to the world, of this vast range is so small that it demands divine authority to make it come out that way. Just the geometries alone, the non-Euclidean geometries alone, there are indefinitely many of them. And it happens that in the small, one of them appears to apply on this planet, and in larger spaces, another applies, but any one of an indefinitely large number could perfectly well apply in the universe. And the suggestion that it's some mystery that could only be explained by God's good graciousness to the physicists just seems to me bizarre, again. Just, you know, something that beggars the imagination. So, I guess the last thing I want to talk about is Dr. Craig's brief rejoinder that that I somehow need, or that he can get away with showing or with asserting that there's no logical incompatibility between God's being omnipotent and benevolent and the existence of suffering. Now, Christian philosophers have been worried about this problem from hell at least since the greatest of them, Leibniz. Okay? And they have done handsprings and twisted themselves up in knots to try to find some explanation. Because logically speaking, if God is omniscient and God is omnipotent and God is truly benevolent, has a totally good will and would never will anything but for the best, then the existence of suffering on our planet, human suffering and natural suffering of other animals, for example, okay, is something that needs desperately to be explained. And we've had, over the course of 400 or 500 years of wrestling with this problem, the free will defense and the mystery mongering, it's, you know, God's will defense, and nobody has managed to provide a satisfactory explanation, and I insist that the problem is logical. And Dr. Craig needs to tell us exactly how an omnipotent God and an entirely benevolent God had to have the Holocaust in order to produce the good outcome, whatever it might be that he intends for our ultimate providence. Couldn't he have just gotten away with World War I or the Great Leap Forward or the 30 Years' War, which killed untold millions, or the bubonic plague that killed 40% of the population of Europe? Did he have to have every one of those in order to produce the kind of beneficent outcome which it is divine providence to expect? I just don't see it. I cannot understand it. I find it offensive, right? And I find it perplexing. And in all honesty, if Dr. Craig could provide me with any kind of a logical, coherent account that could reconcile the evident fact of the horrors of human and infrahuman life on this planet over the last 3.5 billion years with the existence of a benevolent, omnipotent agent, then I will turn Christian. Thank you.
Okay, we now begin our 8-minute rebuttals. Dr. Craig, anytime you're ready. Timer begin when he starts speaking.
I am really excited about that last statement that Dr. Rosenberg made. Honestly, Dr. Rosenberg, if you were to read the work of people like Alvin Plantinga, Peter Van Inwagen, and others on this problem of evil, you would know that hardly anyone today defends the logical version of the problem of evil, because the atheist simply hasn't been able to shoulder the burden of proof required to put it through. Listen to what Paul Draper, who is an agnostic philosopher here in the department at Purdue, says. He says, logical arguments from evil are a dying, parentheses, dead, breed. For all we know, even an omnipotent and omniscient being might be forced to allow evil for the sake of obtaining some important good. Our knowledge of goods and evils and the logical relations they have to each other is much too limited to prove that this could not be the case. In particular, the atheist assumes that if God is all-powerful, he can create just any world that he wants. And that's not necessarily true. If God wills to create free creatures, then he can't guarantee they'll always do what is right. It's logically impossible to make someone freely do something. So God's being all-powerful doesn't mean he can do the logically impossible. So the atheist would have to prove there's a world of free creatures which God could create, which has as much good as this world, but without as much evil. How could he possibly prove that? That's pure speculation. What about the other premise, that if God is all good, then he would create a world without evil? Well, the problem here is that we are assuming that God's purpose is just to make us happy in this life. But on the Christian view, that's false. The purpose of life is not worldly happiness as such, but rather the knowledge of God. And there may be many evils that occur in this lifetime that are utterly pointless with respect to producing worldly happiness, but they may not be pointless with respect to producing a knowledge of God and salvation and eternal life. It's possible that only in a world that is suffused with natural and moral evil, that the optimal number of people would come to know God freely, find salvation and eternal life. So the atheist would have to prove that there's another possible world that has this much knowledge of God and his salvation in it, but which is produced with less evils. How could he possibly prove that? It's pure conjecture. It's impossible to prove those things. And that's why the logical version of the problem of evil has been widely abandoned. Peter Van Inwagen, professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, says it used to be held that evil was incompatible with the existence of God, that no possible world contained both God and evil. So far as I am able to tell, this thesis is no longer defended. So, Dr. Rosenberg, I want to invite you to think about becoming a theist tonight, because the main obstacle that you've presented need not be an obstacle for you anymore. Now, what about the positive arguments that I offered for God's existence? The first one was why anything at all exists, and there's been no response in tonight's debate to this first argument. You can't just say the universe exists without an explanation if it's contingent. If it's contingent, as Dr. Rosenberg says in his book, there could have been nothing. So why is there something rather than nothing? The theist has an explanation, but the atheist, by his own admission, has no explanation. What about the problem of the origin of the universe? I showed that it's no avail to appeal to quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, things don't come into being from non-being, from nothing. They come out of the energy in the vacuum. But for the universe to come into being, it would have to come from literally nothing, because the beginning of the universe is the beginning of all matter and energy and space and time. Again, theism has an explanation for how the universe came into being, but atheism is impotent in this regard. The applicability of mathematics. All Dr. Rosenberg could say is there are various alternative mathematics like non-Euclidean geometries. That doesn't go one inch toward explaining why our physical universe is structured on this incredibly complex mathematical structure and foundation. Again, the theist has an easy explanation. God constructed the universe on this mathematical structure. The naturalist is at a loss to explain it. What about the fine-tuning of the universe? I explained the disastrous results that would ensue if the universe were not fine-tuned, and I also explained why you can't dismiss this problem by the multiverse hypothesis, and there's been no response to that. Intentional states of consciousness. Dr. Rosenberg says, how can one chunk of matter be about another one? I agree with him on this. It can't. That leads him to deny that we ever think about anything. It leads me, rather, to say, but I do think about things, therefore there must be minds. And minds fit nicely into a theistic worldview because God is the ultimate mind, and so the presence of finite minds in this world is nothing mysterious. It fits into a theistic world in a way that it doesn't fit into an atheistic world. As for objective moral values, it's the same situation. Dr. Rosenberg rightly understands that if atheism is true, if metaphysical naturalism is true, there are no objective moral values and duties. He and I actually agree on a great deal. But what I would say is obviously it is wrong to do certain things, and therefore it follows that there must be a foundation for moral values beyond the physical world in God, a transcendent personal being. The resurrection of Jesus, again, you can't discuss this responsibly without getting your fingers dirty and looking at those documents. You can't attack other documents like Joseph Smith or Muhammad and use those to impugn the credibility of the gospel sources. The fact is that the majority of New Testament historians who have investigated these documents have concluded to those three facts that I mentioned. Remember, N.T. Wright says there is firmly established as the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, but the naturalist has no explanation. Finally, God can be personally known and experienced. Why can't God be a properly basic belief for me, grounded in my experience of God? I don't see why not. Finally, what about metaphysical naturalism? How is this relevant in tonight's debate? He says these bizarre consequences that he affirms don't follow from atheism, they follow from scientism. But my argument was that scientism or epistemological naturalism doesn't imply metaphysical naturalism. Remember the case of W.V.O. Quine. But if God does not exist, then I think metaphysical naturalism is true. Metaphysical naturalism doesn't follow from epistemological naturalism, but it does follow from atheism. The most plausible form of atheism is, I think, metaphysical naturalism, but there are all those absurd consequences that result from that that I described. He bites the bullet and affirms these bizarre consequences. Why not step back and say, no, this is crazy. This is not the world we live in. Ours must be a theistic world. If his only obstacle is the logical problem of evil, then that obstacle has now been removed, and Dr. Rosenberg should find himself free to embrace joyfully the existence of God as the answer to these deep questions.
Professor Rosenberg may now begin his 8-minute rebuttal. Timer.
So, just as, of course, Dr. Craig is repeating himself, I guess I don't have much recourse but to repeat myself, because just as he suggests that I haven't answered one or another of his points, he similarly hasn't answered any number of mine. But that's the problem with this kind of a debate and this kind of a form. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because what I would like to be able to do is ask William Lane Craig a question and listen to his answer, and formulate a reply and listen to his answer, and then give a view and listen to his question, which is the way in which philosophical dialogue proceeds, and which enables us at least to find out where the crucial issues are between us and how we could mutually agree to adjudicate these matters. So now, I really need to know why he's so committed to the principle of sufficient reason, which underwrites a good half of the arguments from science which he advances for us. I made the point that the principle of sufficient reason is false. It's not just that it's not known to be true, it's that it's just plain out flat false and disconfirmed all over the galaxy, all over the universe, all over the multiverse, indefinitely many times in infinitesimally small units of time. And I don't understand why he insists that it's just intuitively obvious. It's just, you know, what could be more obvious that from nothing, nothing can come, that if something exists, there had to be a prior entity of some sort which brought it about. We know that alpha particles come into existence for no reason at all every moment in this room. Why should we assume that the universe is any different? Why should we assume that purely quantum mechanical fluctuations symmetry breaking, which we understand is the explanation for why there's matter in the universe and not antimatter, why this process, which produces the characteristic features of our universe and does so without there being a cause for it happening one way or the other, why the symmetry gets broken one way or the other, couldn't be the nature of reality as far back as we can possibly dig in cosmology. Now, let's talk about the argument from evil. I keep hearing these quotes. He's even invoking my best friend, Peter Van Inwagen, asserting that nobody anymore believes that the argument from evil is a problem for theism. Well, not where I come from. Where I come from, that's the first thing that we worry about. How can you reconcile theism and evil? Now, you can reconcile God and evil if you reduce his power from omnipotence, or you reduce his benevolence to only, well, he's pretty good, or he's good most of the time, okay? But even a philosopher like Peter Van Inwagen, who I think is probably the best metaphysician working in our field today, even he can't go any further than in his book, The Problem of Evil, his Gifford Lectures in 2004, he can't go any further than saying that he thinks that the argument from evil is not decisive, that it doesn't absolutely and completely destroy theism. It's not, as he says, a successful argument. And the reasons that he gives, I would be embarrassed to lay before you, because they have to do with an argument called the Sorites, an argument that's been known since the time of the Greeks, and that is the sort of argument that gives philosophy a bad name among more well-grounded, less theoretical people. Professor Craig invoked the free will defense that God gave us free will, and because he gave us free will, he gave us the power to do evil, and the evil is done by us as a result of our exercise of free will. Well, I have three things to say about this. The first is he could have given us free will without giving us the Holocaust or the bubonic plague, okay? He could have done it with given us free will without giving us all the horrors of the history of our species. The second thing is he made some people, apparently, and gave them free will, and they caused no suffering at all, whether it's small children or the saints of the Catholic Church or whoever your favorite a person without sin may be. And the third thing is this. Let's think about the following very simple thought experiment. Suppose I give you all an arithmetic test. You all have free will. You can all choose. I give you an arithmetic test. It's 100 questions, and they're all of the form 3 plus 5 equals, or 16 divided by 2 equals, or the square of 4 equals, okay? And I offer you $1,000 for each right answer and excruciating pain for each wrong answer, right? You all have free will. How many of you are going to give me any wrong answers? None of you. You're all going to have, you know, $10,000 at the end of a 10-question arithmetic test. You all had free will. You all chose freely, and you always gave me the right answer. Why couldn't God have arranged the universe and us so that we all have free will and temptation was never presented to us? Or when it was presented to us, we always chose rightly. Why couldn't God have arranged matters that way, given us free will, and so arranged matters that in our exercise of free will, we never chose evil? We never chose the outcome that produced suffering for anybody. That seems to me a logically coherent possibility, and it's enough to show that the problem of evil remains with us. New Testament scholarship. You know, I have great respect for New Testament scholars and for the higher criticism and for the deep scholars of the Christian religion who study the New Testament. Some of them have told us that 75% of it was forged. And all of us tell us that it was written by people who were illiterate. and most of them recognize that the writings, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, could not have dated from any earlier than 30 or 40 or 50 years after Jesus lived. And of course, the Aramaic in which they were written was completely lost, and all the extant New Testaments are in Greek. And therefore, the opportunity for misrepresentation or mistranscription or other kinds of mistakes was huge, and indeed has been documented by scholarship over the last 200 years. But most of all, why should we accept the credibility of Christian scholars writing about Christian documents? No more than we should accept the scholarship of Islamic scholars writing about Islamic documents or Scientologists writing about Scientology.
Dr. Craig will now begin his closing statement. He has 5 minutes.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Rosenberg for a very stimulating debate this evening. I hope that you've enjoyed it as much as I have. In my closing statement, I'd like to draw together some of the threads of this debate and see if we can come to some conclusions. In tonight's debate, I presented 8 reasons why it's reasonable to believe in God and 8 reasons why metaphysical naturalism is unreasonable, in fact, absurd. Now, Dr. Rosenberg has presented only one argument for atheism tonight, and that is the problem of evil. And it was very clear in his last speech that he hasn't understood it. He says, why couldn't God have created people with free will so that they always chose to do the right thing? This has been dealt with by theists dealing with the problem of evil. And the reason is because the wrong subjunctive conditionals of freedom might be true for God to actualize such a world. There are possible worlds which are not feasible for God to actualize, because if he were to create the creatures in certain circumstances and leave them free, they would go wrong. And as far as we know, for all we know, in any world of free creatures in which there's this much good in the world, there would also be this much evil. And it may not be feasible for God to actualize a world having this much good without this much evil. That doesn't mean the Holocaust is necessary. No, not at all. But it would mean that in a world in which, say, the Holocaust didn't occur, other events would have occurred that would have been comparably evil. So what Dr. Rosenberg, again, would have to show, or the atheist would have to show, is that there is no... he would have to show that God has the ability to create another world, another possible world of free creatures, that would involve this much knowledge of God and eternal salvation as in the actual world, but without as much suffering. And there's no way that the atheist could prove that. It's utter speculation. And that's why the argument is regarded today as bankrupt. Now, with respect to the arguments for metaphysical naturalism, I think what Dr. Rosenberg has done for us is he has described brilliantly what an atheistic world would be like. It is a world in which there is no meaning, no truth, no thoughts about anything, no moral values, no enduring selves, no first-person perspectives. His only mistake lies in thinking that that world is our world. But it manifestly is not. Our world is not Dr. Rosenberg's world. Our world is a world in which we do exist. We do have thoughts about things, and in which there is, therefore, meaning, truth, and value. And Dr. Rosenberg admits that theism provides a better explanation of such a world than does atheism. And since our world is evidently such a world, it follows, I think, that it is reasonable to believe in God. In addition to that, I presented 8 arguments for belief in God. He, in his last speech, says, why are you so committed to the principle of sufficient reason? Because a very modest version of that is plausibly true, namely, that if a contingent thing exists, there's a reason or an explanation why it exists rather than not. And given that principle, which is very plausible and modest, you need an explanation for why the universe exists.
This is especially evident if the universe came into being at some point in the finite past. It can't just come from non-being. I won't repeat what I said about the applicability of mathematics, intentional states of consciousness, objective moral values, the resurrection of Jesus. The sources we have for the resurrection of Jesus go back to within 5 years of the event. And they were not written in Aramaic. He's just incorrect. They were written in Greek. And we have the New Testament in the original language in which it was written. And the text is 99.8% authentic and pure. So doubts on that head are simply groundless. The one thing that we haven't talked about tonight is my eighth point, that God can be personally known and experienced. And I want to close by saying this. I myself wasn't raised in a believing home, although it was a good and loving home. But when I was in high school as a junior, I met a Christian who sat in front of me in German class who shared with me her faith about God's love. I had never heard of this before. I began to read the New Testament, and as I did, I was captivated by the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Well, I went through a period of about 6 months of soul-searching, at the end of which I just came to the end of my rope and gave my life to Christ. And I experienced an inner spiritual rebirth that I've walked with day by day, year by year now for over 40 years. A spiritual reality that I believe you can find as well if you will seek Him with an open mind and an open heart. So as I close tonight, I would encourage you, if you're seeking for God, do what I did. Pick up a New Testament, begin to read it, and ask yourself, could this really be the truth? Could there be a God who loves me and cares for me and gave Himself for me? I believe it could change your life just as it changed mine.
Professor Rosenberg will now give his 5-minute concluding statement.
So here's another positive argument for atheism. It's sort of so obvious that I hadn't thought I should introduce it, and I certainly didn't think I was going to have time. But this back and forth has gone on so long that I've got this last chance, and I'm going to use it. So why is it that God... is a hypothesis that science has so little use for? You may recall when the king of France, Louis XIV, approached Laplace, the great 18th century physicist, and said, "But what is the role of God in your system?" The answer was, "I have no need of that hypothesis." And of course, the reason that science has no need of the hypothesis is that God makes no contribution to the predictive power of any part of any of the sciences. And for that reason, there's no basis on which to invoke God either for explanatory or any other purposes in science. And therefore, science has no more need for, and indeed a considerable reason to deny the existence of God than it has to accept the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. The absence of a role for God in the predictive and explanatory content of science is, quite apart from the problem of evil, the principal reason why 95% of the members of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States are atheists, and why science can provide not only no good basis for theism, but an excellent argument against it. Indeed, if we think back to the invocation of Willard Van Orman Quine, the great American philosopher, by Professor Craig, you'll recall that he pointed out that Quine adopts abstract objects, the objects of mathematics, as existing even though they are abstract, even though they're not concrete, even though they're not physical items in the world. Why? Because they were indispensable to the predictive power of science. And because they were indispensable, Quine had no good argument against them and said that science not only had no good argument against them, but in fact it had a good argument for their existence because of the contribution they made to enabling us to predict detailed experiments, meter readings, right, of scientific experiments, which is the litmus test of reasonability among scientists. And to invoke the objects of mathematics as part of an argument for the existence of God fails to reflect this indispensable fact about the reasons that scientists are committed to them. If God could do as much for science as the number two, physicists would be much more receptive to his existence. So let me end this debate with a little advice from an atheist. Dr. Craig has ended by making a personal statement about the importance of Jesus Christ to his own character and well-being, his own spiritual state. Believe if you want to. Have faith in Jesus Christ if you need to. But do not make yourself vulnerable to reason and evidence. Do not demand that your belief be reasonable. You will be threatened with the loss of your faith. You may well lose your faith. Those who have lost their faith in God are generally those who have felt the need for good reasons, for evidence, for argument. Better that you should take as your slogan, "Credo qui absurdum." I believe because it is absurd. That's a far surer basis. It's not an epistemologically respectable one, but it's a psychologically far firmer basis to believe in the existence of God. Okay? You cannot accept that faith is reasonable, but that doesn't stop you from believing. And, of course, those friends of mine who are devout Christians, of whom I count a number of the people that Professor Craig mentioned tonight, and even Professor Craig, with whom I'm sure I will have a friendly exchange after this debate is over, even Professor Craig, I'm sure, will tell you that that is, in many ways, the firmest basis for commitment to Jesus, faith and not reason. Thank you.